Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. The portion of part three of Immanuel Kant's Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics, which is devoted to the cosmological ideas, is one of the longer sections within that part of the work. And it's also one that's drawn a lot of attention from people who are critics of Kant, advocates of Kant, going further in this direction in terms of dialectic and antinomies. So it's actually a very important section, and we'll have to look at it broken down into parts. Now, we should notice from the very beginning that the cosmological ideas are plural, but they do fall under one sort of very, very general rubric. And he begins this section by talking about that. He tells us, I term this idea, and there he uses it singularly, cosmological, because it always takes its object in this case, from the sensible world, and it does not need any other world than that whose object is given to sense. And it's quite interesting there. Kant will actually use two different words for object, objekt and Gegenstand, in that very last clause of the sentence. The object is the object, right? The Gegenstand is the objekt for the sense. And so he says it remains in this respect in its native home, and it doesn't become transcendent. Now, if it's not becoming transcendent, then we don't really need to worry about it, do we? Because we're only concerned with these transcendental ideas because they do, in fact, go beyond the boundaries of experience and get us into all sorts of hot water, seeking after noumena or things in themselves. And Kant is going to say, yeah, that's actually what's going to happen in the next sentence, right? So he says, the cosmological idea extends, evitet, extends is a good translation there, goes further, right? It extends the connection, the Beziehung, the interconnection of the conditioned with its condition, right? What are we talking about there? It's tempting to say that this has to do strictly just with causality. And what we're going to see is that cause is going to get brought up in two different ways here. But it's really a broader idea of something conditioning, something as, you know, the conditioner of something else, which is thereby conditioned. It is determined. It is brought to be in a certain way. And so he says that it extends beyond experience by looking at this relationship of the condition with its condition, whether mathematical or dynamical, so far that experience can never keep up with it. So we inevitably take it beyond the limitations, the boundaries of experience. And so he says, it's therefore, with regard to this point, always an idea whose object can never be adequately given in any experience. And he's already given an example of this with the psychological ideas. Now he's going to talk about this in terms of, for example, the entire universe, which we can't have an experience of, right? Because we cannot take in the totality of the world, right? And so, you know, he's going to say, when it comes to each of what we're going to call the antinomies of pure reason, we're going inevitably beyond experience into something else. And this is going to raise some issues. Now, he also tells us, interestingly, in the first place, the use of a system of categories becomes here so obvious and unmistakable that even if there were not several other proofs of it, this alone would sufficiently prove it indispensable in the system of pure reason. This is what leads him to talk about there being four kinds of dialectical assertions, right? And in each of these, though, he says, These refer to the absolute completeness, right? And this is something that we've talked about quite a bit as we've moved through this, Vollständigkeit, right? Being brought to fruition, being brought to perfection. So the completeness of what? A series, a haya, of conditions for a given condition. Each of these is referring not just to one single relation, but perhaps an entire series of things which are causes and effects, you could say, or conditioned, and each in turn, right? So he tells us that in conformity with these cosmological ideas, there's only four kinds of dialectical assertions of pure reason. And dialectical here, sometimes people think that dialectic is a good thing. And, you know, it is for somebody like Hegel or Marx who are coming later, dialectical as opposed to non-dialectical. For Kant, dialectical always signals that there's some sort of illusion going on, some sort of falsity, some sort of getting things wrong or falling into a place that we don't want to be. So he tells us that because these are dialectical, they prove that to each of them on equally specious, notice the term there, specious principles of pure reason, a contradictory assertion stands opposed. And so this is going to be a big problem. And so for each of these, and there's four of them, right? We have a thesis, or a Satz in German, and then we have an antithesis, a Gegensatz. Literally, it's contradictory. So, you know, sentence, counter-sentence, you could also translate it that way. And he tells us that this antinomy, now what is an antinomy? An antinomy is where both of these can be given some sort of reasonable grounding or justification, but they both can't be true at the same time. As a matter of fact, it could be possible that both are false at the same time, as we're going to see. And so you got to ask yourself, well, what the hell's going on here, right? What is happening with reason as it is trying to go beyond the boundaries of experience and figure things out about stuff that really matters to us? So he tells us that this is not arbitrarily invented, but founded in the nature of human reason. So we're going to look at that connection in just a bit. But first, let's talk about what these four are. So he talks about mathematical and dynamical, and so we can associate them into groups of two. The first two are mathematical, so, you know, the world, everything in the world, right? That's mathematical, quantitative. And the others are dynamical, having to do with causality itself. So what is the first one? The world has, as to time and space, a beginning or limit, right? In parentheses, Grenze, and beginning Anfang. So it's not saying just the world per se, the world in relation to time and space, which is how we perceive the world, it has some sort of beginning in time or a limit to the extent of the world. Now, you can argue that, and we'll look at how he does that in a little bit. But we can also say the world is, as to time and space, infinite. So this is really containing two different connected things. It doesn't have a beginning, which means that the world would be eternal, right? But it also means that the world wouldn't have a endpoint. It would be infinite in space as well. And we can argue for both of these. So which one's right? Well, that's a problem for pure reason, isn't it? Let's look at the second one. Similarly dealing with the world. Everything in the world is constituted out of the simple. So there's some sort of simple basis that we could get to. You know, for a long time, people thought that was atoms. The very word atom means unable to be divided further, right? Atmein in Greek. And then, you know, we said, oh, subatomic particles. Atoms are actually these really cool things that we had in, you know, chemistry class with electrons whizzing around the outside in a nucleus of protons and neutrons. And then we were like, all right, we hit bottom. Nope. there's quarks, right? And so we can keep going down further and further and further. But, you know, this one is asserting there's going to be some bedrock that you're going to hit sooner or later. And we're going to be able to say, aha, we have reached the simple. Now, you're going to have a lot of simples in order to make that work. To that, we can oppose this antithesis. There is nothing simple, but everything is composite. There is no bottom level, no bedrock that you can ever reach. Everything can be broken down even further. So these are the mathematical antinomies, we can say, theses and antitheses associated with them. Then we get to others, which Kant calls dynamical. There are in the world causes through freedom. Now, that takes a little bit of unpacking. What's he talking about there? The issue of what we often term free will. Can we actually be causes of our own actions through our own freedom? Or are we always conditioned? Are we, in a certain respect, self-moved movers, to use an earlier terminology going all the way back to Aristotle and Plato? Or are we always conditioned, right, by what has come before, what is within us, what is driving us? So Kant is not framing this in terms of human beings or the will, but he's talking about causality. Are there causes that work freely? Or is there no freedom whatsoever, but all is nature? Now, you can say, well, wait a second, why would nature be unfree? Human nature, after all, shouldn't that be free? Well, you know, remember that for Kant, what nature means is a whole system of appearances that are governed by laws. So if all is nature, that means that everything is conditioned by causes and there is no freedom whatsoever. And you can argue either side of this plausibly. So we've got a problem, right? Then finally, we get to the last antinomy. In the series of world causes, there is some necessary being. And this is often, you know, part of arguments for the existence of God. You could think, for example, of Thomas Aquinas's Third Way. So in the series of world causes, everything is connected, cause and effect. There is some necessary being, and that'll be at the start of all of this. The necessary means it has to be the way that it is. It must exist, right? So that's one possibility. But we could also say there is nothing necessary in the world, but in this series, all is contingent. Everything could be different than it is, including the stuff that came before causally. There's no absolutely necessary being. So with each of these, thesis, Satz, and antithesis, Gegensatz, and Kant is going to tell us something very interesting about this before he starts going into detail. He says, and this is in 52a, "Here is the most singular phenomenon of human reason, no other instance of which can be shown in its any other use. If, as is commonly done, we represent to ourselves the appearances of the sensible world as things in themselves," which, you know, Kant has said we can't do that, or we shouldn't do that, "then we assume the principles of their combination as principles universally valid of things in themselves, not merely of experience, we are going to have an unexpected conflict which can never be removed in the common dogmatic way." Why? Because the thesis, as well as the antithesis, can be shown by equally clear, evident, and irresistible proofs. So this goes beyond just, you know, both of these are possible, both of these are probable, both of these make sense. He's saying you can actually prove both sides of the antithesis, and not just with any old proofs, equally clear, evident, and irresistible proofs. So this is a problem, right? So reason, he says, is divided against itself, and skeptics love this, as he says. It actually gives them joy, right? But the critical philosopher can't be all that happy with this. And so he goes on and he says, how do we wind up in these problems? He says, we can blunder in various ways in metaphysics without any fear of being detected in falsehood. Why? Because we can never be refuted by experience if we just avoid self-contradiction. Well, none of these can be refuted by experience, right? You can't look at the world and figure out whether it has a beginning or whether it's eternal. You can't look at the world and our experience of it and figure out whether there are basic building blocks that are completely simple or whether everything is composite. You can't look at the world or even at ourselves and say that, yes, there are definitely or there are definitely not causes through freedom, nor can you have any sort of experience which is going to give you the existence or the non-existence of a necessary being. So experience isn't going to help us. We have to look at the possibility of contradiction. And so he says, the only possible way in which reason could have revealed unintentionally its secret dialectic would be when it were made to ground an assertion on a universally admitted principle and deduce the exact contrary with the greatest accuracy of inference from another which is equally granted. And he says, that's actually the case here with regard to four natural ideas of reason. Four assertions on the one side, as many counter assertions on the other side, each consistently following from universally acknowledged principles. So what does this reveal to us? Well, this dialectical illusion of pure reason, as he calls it. And then there's a footnote where he says something really quite interesting here. He says, nature itself seems to have established it, the antinomy of pure reason, the fact that we can argue plausibly, actually, conclusively for each of these sides. Nature seems to have established it with a view to stagger reason in its daring pretensions and to force it to self-examination. For every proof which I have given both of the thesis and antithesis, I pledge myself to be responsible and thereby to show the certainty of the inevitable antinomy of reason. And so this will lead us to investigate the ultimate foundation of all the cognition of pure reason with me more thoroughly, as he did in the Critique of Pure Reason. What he's suggesting here, without providing any proof, just saying, this is an interesting idea, is that the fact that we can actually come up with these antinomies, and we can discover there is a dialectic of pure reason, shows that something in nature, something in the way things are constituted, wants us to use our reason as a critical faculty. Does Kant provide any proof for this? No, it's a mere suggestion, but a very interesting one, is it not? So this is the beginning of setting out the cosmological ideas in that section of the Prolegomena.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.